and as she opened her mouth to ask for her father, Ramon's strict injunction came back to her with all its force and threat. Your disobedience will have dire consequences for Nicky. She replaced the receiver on its cradle without speaking, and resigned herself to wait for the promised contact. Nothing happened for 6 days. She never left the flat, not daring to put herself beyond the reach of the telephone. She rang nobody, spoke to nobody except the housekeeper, and tried to keep herself occupied by reading and watching television. The uncertainty aggravated her despair, and she found that although she stared at the pages of her book or at the small flickering screen of the television set, the printed words and the images were meaningless. Only her agony was real. Only her loss had poignant meaning. Only her pain abided. She could barely bring herself to eat, and within 3 days her milk flow had dried up. She lost weight dramatically. Her hair, which was one of the high points of her beauty, turned dull and dry. Her face in the mirror was gaunt. Her eyes sank into bruised-looking cavities, and her golden-amber Mediterranean tan became sallow and yellow, like the skin of a malaria sufferer. She waited, and the waiting was torture. Each hour was an insupportable eternity. Then, on the 6th day, the telephone rang. She snatched it up with desperate haste before the 2nd peal. "I have a message from Ramon." It was a woman's voice with an elusive accent, probably mid-European. "Leave now immediately. Take a taxi to the junction of Royal Hospital Road and the embankment. Walk down the embankment towards Westminster. Somebody will greet you with the name Red Rose. Follow their orders," said the caller. "Repeat these instructions, please." Breathlessly, Isabella obeyed. "Good," said the woman, and broke the connection. Isabella had not walked further than 100 yards along the embankment above the Thames, when a small, unmarked van passed her, travelling slowly in the same direction. It pulled into the curb ahead of her, and as she drew level with it, the rear door opened to reveal a middle-aged woman in grey overalls sitting on the side bench of the body of the van. "Red Rose," she said, and Isabella recognized her voice from their telephone conversation. "Get in." Quickly, Isabella slipped into the van and sat on the bench opposite the woman. She slammed the door, and immediately the van pulled away. The body of the van was without windows or any opening except for the ventilator in the roof above Isabella's head. She could not see out, and though she tried to track their course by the turns and stops, she was soon totally confused and abandoned the attempt. "Where are you taking me?" she asked the woman opposite her. "Silence, please." And Isabella resigned herself. She pulled her collar up around her ears and thrust her hands deep into the pockets of her anorak. They drove for 23 minutes by her wristwatch, and then the van stopped again and the rear door was opened from outside. They were in a parking garage. She judged from the unpainted concrete pillars that supported the low roof and from the steep access ramp at the far end of the long, narrow chamber, that it was an underground parking facility. The woman in the grey overalls took her arm and helped her down from the van. The touch of her hand made Isabella aware of just how powerful she was. The hand felt like the paw of a gorilla. And she towered above Isabella, with wide, meaty shoulders under the grey cloth. "This way," she ordered. Still holding her arm, she led Isabella to the lift doors opposite the van. Despite the painful grip, Isabella glanced around her quickly. There were a dozen or so other vehicles parked in the bays alongside the van. At least 2 of them had diplomatic number plates. The doors of the lift opened, and the woman pushed Isabella into it. A glance at the control panel showed Isabella that her assumption had been correct. The lighted stage indicator showed that they were at basement level 2. The woman pushed the button for the 3rd floor, and they rode up in silence, until the lift stopped with the stage indicator at level 3. And her escort urged her out into a bare corridor with cork flooring. They walked down it side by side, and still in silence. The corridor was empty, and the doors on each side closed. As they approached the end of the corridor, the facing door slid open. Another large female, with flat Slavic features, dressed also in grey overalls, ushered them into what appeared to be a small lecture room, or an intimate movie theatre. A double row of easy chairs faced the raised dais, and the screen that covered the far wall. Isabella's escort led her to the chair in the front row centre. "Sit down," she said, and Isabella sank down on the smooth, cold plastic padding. The two women moved around and took up their position, standing behind Isabella. For several minutes there was silence. Then the small door to the right of the dais opened, and a man came through. He moved slowly, stiffly, like a frail and sick old man. His hair was dead white with a yellowish tinge, and hung over his forehead and ears. His features were very pale, lined, and seamed with age and suffering, so that Isabella felt a twinge of sympathy for him, until the light caught his eyes. With a small jolt of intense distaste, she recognized those eyes. Once she had been with her father on a chartered fishing boat out of Black River. Shaza had been trolling a live bonito along the oceanic drop-off under the shadow of Le Mans Brabant, on the island of Mauritius, when he had hooked into a gigantic Mako shark. After a battle which lasted 2 hours, he had dragged the creature alongside. As its pointed snout broke through the surface, Isabella had been leaning over the rail, and she had looked into its eyes. They were black and pitiless, without definite iris or pupil, two holes that seemed to reach down into hell itself. Those were the same eyes that studied her now. She held her breath under their implacable scrutiny, until at last the man spoke. Then his voice came as a surprise. It was low and hoarse. She had to lean forward slightly to make sense of the words.
"Isabella Courtney, from now on we will never use that name again in any communication. You will be referred to, and you will refer to yourself only as Red Rose. Do you understand?"
She nodded, not trusting her voice to reply. He lifted the cigarette that smouldered between his fingers and drew deeply upon it. He spoke again through a cloud of exhaled smoke.
"I have a message for you in the form of a videotape recording."
He stepped down from the dais and took the chair at the end of the row furthest from her. As he settled into it, the overhead lights dimmed. She heard the faint hum of electronic equipment, and then the screen lit up. The scene it displayed was a bare white tiled room, a laboratory or an operating theatre, she decided. There was a table in the centre of the room, and on it was a glass-sided tank, much like one of the aquariums in which ornamental tropical fish were displayed in a pet shop. The tank was filled with water to within a few inches of the top. On the tabletop beside the tank stood some sort of electronic cabinet and array of instruments and medical paraphernalia. She recognized a portable oxygen cylinder and an oxygen mask. The mask was a diminutive model suitable for infants and very small children. A man was busy at the table. His back was towards the camera, and his features were hidden. He wore some type of white laboratory coat. He turned to face the camera, and Isabella saw that he wore a cloth theatre cap and surgical mask. His voice was dispassionate as he began to speak, and his accent was foreign, East European. He seemed to be addressing Isabella directly out of the screen.
"Your orders were to speak to nobody, not in Malaga or elsewhere. You deliberately disobeyed those orders."
He was staring at her from the screen with disembodied eyes.
"I'm sorry," she replied, as though he could hear her. "I was so worried, I couldn't—"
"Silence," hissed one of the women behind her chair. A hand fell on her shoulder. Fingers dug into her flesh with a strength that made her wince. On the screen, the man was still speaking.
"You were warned that your disobedience would have dire consequences for your son. You chose to ignore that warning. What you are about to witness is a first demonstration of the seriousness of those instructions."
He made a gesture to somebody off camera, and a figure entered from the side. It was impossible to tell whether it was a male or a female, for it also wore a cloth cap and surgical mask that covered all the face and head except for the narrow strip across the eyes. A full-length surgical gown fell to below the knees and was tucked into the tops of white rubber boots.
"This is a qualified doctor who will monitor all the proceedings," he explained.
The figure carried a bundle in its arms. Only when it deposited the bundle on the table beside the glass-sided tank, and a tiny bare leg kicked free of the swaddling cloth, Isabella realized that it was a child. With quick, trained hands, the doctor unwrapped the infant, and the video camera zoomed in on Nicky as he lay naked on the tabletop, kicking his legs in the air, and his gurgles sounded in the quiet room. Isabella thrust the fingers of one hand into her mouth and bit down on them hard to prevent herself crying out again. The doctor placed two small black suction caps on Nicky's bare chest. Thin wires dangled from them, and the doctor connected them to the electronic cabinet and switched it on. The digital figures in the panel lit with a green glow, and the narrator explained in a neutral voice, "The child's breathing and heartbeat will be recorded." The doctor looked up from his equipment and nodded. The narrator moved around behind the table and faced the camera. "You are Red Rose," he said with peculiar emphasis on the name, "and in future you will obey all orders given to you by that name." He reached down and took both of Nicky's ankles in one hand and lifted him. Nicky let out a squawk of surprise as he hung head down like a small pink wingless bat. "You are about to witness the consequences of disobedience." He swung the child and held him head down over the glass-sided tank. Nicky arched his back and tried to lift his head. He waved his arms and clenched and unclenched his fists, making small noises of uncertainty and alarm. Slowly the narrator lowered the child headfirst into the water, and the sounds of his little voice were cut off abruptly. The video camera zoomed in through the glass side of the tank and focused on his face below the surface of the water. The color resolution of the film was true to life. Isabella screamed wildly and tried to struggle out of her chair. The two women seized her from behind and forced her down again. On the screen, Nicky struggled in the narrator's grip. Underwater, his face was contorted, and silver bubbles streamed from his nostrils. His face seemed to swell and darken. Isabella was still screaming and fighting when, on the screen, the masked doctor looked up quickly from the heart monitor and said sharply, in Spanish, "Stop! That is enough, comrade." Immediately, the man lifted the child clear of the tank. Water streamed from Nicky's nostrils and open mouth, and for long seconds he could not utter a sound except for his tiny gasping breaths. The narrator laid him down on the table, and the doctor clapped the oxygen mask over his swollen face and pressed down on his chest with the palm of his hand to induce regular breathing. Within a minute, the digital readout on the cabinet had settled back to normal, and Nicky's movements were stronger. He howled into his mask with shock and outrage, his voice becoming louder and stronger with each cry. The doctor removed the mask and stepped back from the table. He nodded at the narrator. Once again, he seized Nicky's ankles and lifted him over the tank. Nicky seemed to realize what was coming. His cries of protest reached a higher, terrified pitch. He kicked and writhed in the man's grip.
"He's my son!" Isabella screamed. "You can't! You mustn't do this to my baby!"
The narrator lowered Nicky's head once again below the surface, and the child fought with all his strength. His frenzied exertions racked the tiny body. Water splashed over the edge of the tank, and once again his face changed color swiftly. Isabella screamed at him,
"Stop it! I'll do anything you say, just stop torturing my baby, please! Please!"
Once again the doctor intervened with a sharp warning, and this time, when Nicky was lifted clear of the water, his movements were weaker. He made little choking, cawing sounds, and a mixture of water and vomit erupted from his open, inverted mouth, and silver strings of mucus slid down from his flared nostrils. The doctor worked swiftly, his alarm apparent, and he said something to the other man. The narrator looked up at the camera, seeming to stare directly at Isabella.
"We almost miscalculated that time. We exceeded the limit of safety."
He and the doctor put their heads closer together and spoke so softly that Isabella could not catch the words, and then the narrator addressed her again.
"That concludes our demonstration for the time being. I sincerely hope that it will not be necessary for you to witness another like it. It would be harrowing for you to have to watch the amputation of the child's limbs without anesthetic, or eventually his strangulation in front of the camera. Of course, it will depend on you, and the degree of cooperation that you are prepared to afford us."
The image faded, and the screen went blank.